Exodus chapter 3. Now Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the far side of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within a bush. Moses saw that though the bush was on fire, it did not burn up. So Moses thought, I will go over and see this strange sight, why the bush does not burn up. When the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, here I am. Do not come any closer, God said. Take off your sandals, for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey, the home of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. And now the cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. So now go, I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be the sign that to you that it is I who have sent you. When you've brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. Moses said to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what shall I tell them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. That is what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. God also said to Moses, say to the Israelites, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, the name by which I am to be remembered from generation to generation. Go, assemble the elders of Israel and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, appeared to me and said, I have watched over you and have seen what has been done to you in Egypt. And I have promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt into the land of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites and Jebusites. A land flowing with milk and honey. The elders of Israel will listen to you. Then you and the elders are to go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God. But I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless a mighty hand compels him. So I will stretch out my hand and strike the Egyptians with all the wonders that I will perform among you. After that, he will let you go. And I will make the Egyptians favorably disposed towards this people, so that when you leave, you will not go empty-handed. Every woman is to ask her neighbor and any woman living in her house for articles of silver and gold and for clothing, which you will put on your sons and daughters, and so you will plunder the Egyptians." Ridley Scott is one of the most famous, if not probably the most famous, British film director of all time. You will have heard of some of his films, I guess. Gladiator, some of you may have seen that film, that's Ridley Scott. He's famous for a set of films that are particularly disturbing, and I'm certainly not recommending you go and watch them, but he's famous for the Alien films. They're a science fiction set of films that deal with explorers in space who meet aliens, basically. Now, in the last 3 years, he's released 2 more films, Prometheus and Alien Covenant, which has just finished its run at the cinemas. They're the sort of films 5 and 6 in the series of those films, really disturbing films, very violent. But what's interesting about these last 2 films is the absolute fascination with the characters in the films about who made them. That's the great driving theme of both of those films, Prometheus and Alien Covenant. Who made us? So these corporations in the future spend millions and millions and millions of dollars sending people on a mission, on missions to find the creators, the people who made us. So this is a very popular idea today, isn't it? That we're not actually, you know, we didn't begin here. There's some alien race that has seeded us in some way. Now, this is a quote from the beginning of the latest film, which is quite interesting. This is a quote from one of these, from the man who sort of commissions this great quest into space to find the creators. And this is what he says. All these wonders of art, design, human ingenuity, all utterly meaningless in the face of the only question that matters. Where do we come from? I refuse to believe that mankind is a random byproduct of molecular circumstance. No more than the result of mere biological chance. No, there must be more. It's an interesting little speech, isn't it? That he makes to a robot, funnily enough, who he's created, who wants to know if he was created by this man, where did this man come from? Now, Ridley Scott, in his films, in Gladiator as well, to a certain degree, is fascinated with this idea of where do we come from? What's our origins? Who made us? Is it possible, even more than that, to know the person or persons who made us? And of course, he's not alone in that. There are strong voices today that suggest that people have grown out of religion. We don't need any of that nonsense anymore. We understand that we are random products of a universe that itself is just a random product of an explosion. That view, which is pushed so strongly, is not held by the majority of people. The majority of people are very interested in the issue of where did I come from? Who made me? And if it is God, what's he like? And can I know him? Many think of religion as the quest to discover this original creator, this prime mover, this one who started it all off. So folk study religion on the basis that it's mankind, humanity's grasping after the one who made us. But what if, rather than us seeking after him, what if that original creator spoke to us and revealed himself to us? What if that was the case? Well, the passage this morning, Exodus 3, is exactly that. It is God stepping into time and history and revealing himself. This is not Moses' quest to find God. This is God stepping to Moses and revealing himself. This is God taking the initiative and showing Moses and consequently us what he's like. Two things to see this morning. First of all, God reveals himself. It is God who takes the initiative to show us what he's like. And secondly, he reveals himself as the rescuer. Where did we leave Moses last time? Well, he was chased out of Egypt because of hot-headed indiscretion, and he's now living in the back of beyond in Midian. What is this former prince of Egypt doing? Well, he's tending sheep. Nothing wrong with that, of course. But he's gone from being a man who was walking the palace courts in Egypt, taught in all the wisdom of the time, who was mighty in word and deed, to a humble shepherd. And the Bible is really clear that this is God's plan. This is not an accident. God was in this. God was moving behind all of these things. Now, Moses wasn't a young man. I hinted at this last week. He was 40 when he was chased out of Egypt. And it's another 40 years before we read of this incident here in chapter 3. So we've had a long time span over these three chapters. Here we are with an 80-year-old shepherd, and God is just about to start using this man. Just about to start using him. Don't you find that encouraging? Doesn't it give you hope? 80 years old and God has major plans ahead for Moses. It seems to me that we limit God if we say that we're too old to be useful. God is an expert at using anything and anyone he chooses to. He's the Lord. He's in charge. He'll use whatever he wants. And even if the rest of our society is slightly ageist, which I think it is, God is not. God doesn't categorise us by how many years we've lived on the planet. Of course, compared to him, it's a drop in the ocean. 80 years, 100 years. God is committed to using people whatever age they're at and wherever they are. And in fact, it would be true to say that if you're still on this planet, which I assume you are if you're actually here this morning, at least in body, then there is a reason why you're still on this planet. I don't believe that there's any accidents in this world. It's all part of God's sovereign, eternal purpose. The reason that you're still alive today, whether you know it or not, whether you acknowledge him or not, is because God still wants you to be alive today. The main point, though, here is that at 80 years old, Moses gets his first real understanding of who God is. While tending sheep, he takes them right to the back of the desert, that's right to the southwest of the wilderness, and there he sees an amazing sight. While grazing his father-in-law's flock around Mount Horeb, Mount Sinai as we also know it, he sees a bush on fire. Now, that probably wasn't a very unusual thing. It's a hot, arid, dry place. But there is something unusual about this particular burning bush. It doesn't go black and turn to dust. This burning bush keeps burning and keeps burning. Well, of course, Moses wants to see this strange sight, so he goes over. He's not prepared for what happens next because he gets the shock of his life. God speaks to him from a bush. Now, that is as strange as it sounds. God speaking from a bush is not something that happens every day. Not in Bible times, not in our day. It just does not happen. In fact, I think this is the only time that it ever happens in the whole of history. God speaks from a burning bush to a man who's 80 years old, who hasn't had really very much experience of God at all up to this point. And it is God who takes the first step. It is God who decides to reveal himself to Moses. Without this divine step of mercy, Moses would never have understood who God was. And what does God reveal in this momentous encounter at Horeb? Well, after the sight of the bush and God's first call to Moses, he tells Moses to take off his shoes, which is a strange request. It's not, you know, when you go to some people's house, they do insist you take off their shoes. We had some friends in another part of the country who had the thickest pile white carpet I've ever seen in my life, and you even feared to wear coloured socks as you're walking into the house. Well, it's not like that. That's not what it's not that God had a special bit of carpet in the air, really wanted to keep clean. It was to do with who God is, his character, his nature. It was a sign of respect. It was because he's holy. That's why he takes his shoes off. Moses is not to rush into his presence. He's to show reverence. And he does this by externally removing his shoes. And God gives Moses another terrifying revelation. He says this, verse 6, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. At this, Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Why was Moses afraid, do you think? Well, he realizes, I think, that he's talking to not just an angel, not just some sort of spiritual presence, but he's speaking to the Lord himself. But if you're sort of paying attention as you read, you'll notice there's some contradiction going on here. Just look at the text again, verse 2. Verse 2 of chapter 3 reads like this. Then the angel of the Lord appeared to him in flames of fire from within the bush. The angel of the Lord. Then verse 4, when the Lord saw that he'd gone over to look, God called to him from within the bush. So the question, of course, you're asking is, who's in the bush? Who is it? Is it the angel of the Lord, or is it the Lord? Is it God? Who's in the bush? John Calvin says that, as many before him had said, that this is actually Jesus. The messenger or angel from the Lord, who is actually the Lord. And that's what I think too. I agree with that. I think this is a pre-incarnate, before 2,000 years ago, pre-incarnate, before the virgin birth, pre-incarnate appearance of the Lord Jesus. That's who can be the messenger of the Lord and the Lord at the same time. It's Jesus. Was Moses excited? Would you be excited to meet with Jesus? I'll tell you what I'd really like to meet. I'm really looking forward to meeting. It's going to be a great day to see him. Faith's okay, but you know, it'll be better to see him, won't it? Well, Moses, if anything, seems to be in deep awe, and so he should be. This is God, not just the God of the day, but he's the God of his forefathers. Hundreds of years before Moses existed, this God was working and watching, directing his universe. And Moses is humbled and in awe. And I think that's something that I need to realise, and we need to realise too. Isn't it easy to think that the world is all about us, that it all revolves around us, that everything that happens is about us? To think that we are the centre of history and that all the momentous events of history will occur in our lifetime. But the revelation from God here is that long before Moses arrived on the scene, he was here. And actually, the world revolves around Jesus, not around us. Before ever you were here, Moses, I was looking after Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It's quite a humbling thing to hear, isn't it? Elsewhere in the Bible, we're told that with the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is like a day, which means, poetically, that he is eternal. That's what it means. He is the God who was the God of my father, and the God of my grandfather, and the God of my great-grandfather. He saw them, and he knew them. And now he sees me, and he knows me. I find that profoundly humbling. We're no great power in the universe. God doesn't look at us and go, wow, they're impressive. I'm sorry to break that to you, but he doesn't look at you and go, wow, you are impressive. He does love you, but he's seen it all because he made it all. So God is holy, he is eternal, but then in verses 13 to 15 we see something even more stunning. Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me what is his name, then what shall I say to them? And you probably think that's a bit weird. Why does Moses go for that tack? Why is he asking for a name? Well, of course, it's what I was trying to explain to the children, simply. Names in Bible times are so significant because they say something about character. So what he's asking is not just what's your given name, what's the moniker by which I know you. It is, what are you like? How do we understand you? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. That's what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. The reply is profound, isn't it? It's a strange reply. It's a reply that, quite rightly, makes you wonder, what does it mean, I am? It doesn't sound like much of a name. It's a very strange name. I am who I am. That's our translation in English, and you'll notice in most of the translations of the Bible, you'll come across the word Lord in capital letters. It's not because they're showing special respect to that word in some way. It's because it's a way of writing in English this name that God gave to Moses. In fact, you may know that the Jews considered this name so holy, they wouldn't even say it. So they substitute another word for it throughout their Old Testament, through their scriptures, through the Old Testament as we know it. They put Jehovah in there because they won't say the Yahweh name because it's too holy, too precious. And you can understand that, can't you? If God gives this terrifically personal name to Moses, and then he instructs him later on that anyone who misuses that name is guilty, then to take that name on your lips, there would be a certain fear of doing that wrongly, wouldn't there? But, except for this. If you say to me, what's your name? And I say to you, well, my name is the Reverend Lintott. I'm telling you something about myself there, aren't I? I'm telling you something about my job, perhaps. I'm telling you about something about the way that I want you to know me. And what I'm doing is I'm pushing you away by that, aren't I? Or if I say to you, I want you to know me as Mr. Lintott, again, there's respect in that, I understand that, but I'm pushing you away. But if I say to you, I'm Paul, and I want you to know me as Paul, there's something very intimate about that, isn't there? I'm inviting you to know me. When God says to Moses, my name is Yahweh, that is the name he wants to be known by. That is his personal name that describes so much about him. But that is an invitation into intimate relationship with Moses. And then subsequently from Moses, all of God's people going down through the Old Testament, and then supremely in the name of Jesus, Yahweh saves. Yeshua, Yahweh saves, is that intimate, personal name that God gives to Moses. And then we see God come down in Jesus. Yahweh's come down to save. It's profoundly personal and wonderful. Yahweh, the word, the Hebrew word, comes from a verb to be. I am what I am. In Christian thinking, we often talk about God not needing anything. We talk about the word aseity, and that comes from this word, I am what I am. In other words, God is not dependent on you or I. He doesn't need you or I. He loves you or I, and he invites us into rich personal relationship with him. But he doesn't need us. He's not like the gods of the Romans or the Greeks, who are desperate for the worship of people to give them power and dependent, therefore, on their worshippers. God's not dependent on us. I was reading in my quiet time day before yesterday that great psalm where God says, if I was hungry, I wouldn't tell you. I've got the cattle on 1,000 hills. I own everything. I am who I am. I need nothing. Within the Trinity, within Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, they have everything that they could possibly need. Love, fellowship, joy, everything. Now, it's also useful to know that in Hebrew, this is sort of true, they don't have tenses like we have tenses in English. So we would say, I am in church, or I will be in church, or I was in church. Yeah, you get that. That's what how tenses work. In Hebrew, it doesn't quite work like that. So when God says, I am what I am, it could also be translated perfectly legitimately. It could be translated, I was who I was, or I am who I am, or I will be who I will be. All of those three are perfectly possible translations of it. Now, that's not as useless as you might think. That's quite useful, because it may be that God is saying here to Moses, I will be what I will be. So you watch and you will see me over these next few months as you're going into Egypt, as you see me demonstrating through my actions what I am. I will be what I will be. Watch, Moses. See my mighty hand at work. So there's maybe something of that in it. Which leads to sort of three conclusions. Firstly, God reveals himself by his actions, and that's what the book of Exodus is, I think, primarily about. It is God showing us what God looks like. Second conclusion from all of that, mind-bending stuff, is that God is unchanging. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. What he was then, he is now. What he will be in the future is what he was. He doesn't change. That's very encouraging, where we live in a world where so many things are changing, to know that the God that we worship is not changing, immutable. And thirdly, it probably suggests that he is eternal. His name hints at that. The timeless one. I just am Moses. The point I'm trying to make here, not very well, is that you can't put God in a test tube. God is bigger than any simple name. He isn't the sun god or the god of war or the god of seas. He's not like the Egyptian gods that he will be going up against in due course. He defies simple analysis and categorizing. You can't put him in a box and then walk all around him and then sort of comprehend him in the full. The God of the Bible is bigger than the human mind can comprehend. The full scope of his nature and attributes are above and beyond what we can actually comprehend. He is simply, I am the self-existent one. Now, that doesn't mean we can't begin to know him and understand him. That's exactly the point here. God chose to reveal himself to Moses. He chose to make himself known so we can start to know him and start to know him truly. But there is a warning for us in this name that God is not going to be summed up by any simple system of theology or course in systematics. You can't go to Bible college and study for 3 or 5 years and know everything about God. It doesn't work like that. He's bigger than that. It will take an eternity to get to know the eternal and infinite God. That, for me, actually, is one of the great things about heaven. Heaven sounds very boring until you realise that an infinite God will take an infinite amount of time to get to know. He is infinitely interesting, infinitely loving, infinitely complex. So it's going to take an infinite amount of time to find out how infinitely wonderful he is. So don't think boring when you think heaven. And the application for us in this first point this morning is very simple. God's not like us. He's holy. He's eternal. He is a God who reveals himself in action. He is a God who is bigger than we are. You know that children's song, Our God is a Great Big God? Our God is a Great Big God. You almost got me singing there. I used to think those kind of songs are stupidly childish. You know, God is bigger. I mean, why sing it like that? But of course, actually, in very simple language, it does encapsulate this idea. God is more complex, more wonderful, more, I was about to say more infinite. You can't even do that. He's infinite. He's just wonderful. Our God is a great big God. And he holds us in his hand. That's the God who knows us. That's the God who reveals himself to us. So we've got to be very careful when we're reading our Bibles not to construct God in our own image. People do this all the time, and they accuse Christians of doing it as well. They say that God didn't make man in his image, we've made him in our image. We've constructed him to be just like us. Well, that's a fair criticism, because we do a lot of that. And the God of the Bible is bigger than we understand, and we mustn't come to those bits of the Bible that we find difficult and say, I'm not going to believe that because it doesn't fit into my pattern of what God's like. God is bigger than we understand. And so the complexity and wonder of that, as he's revealed in Scripture, should make us go, wow, I didn't think you were like that. By the time you get into the New Testament, of course, you get these wonderful I am sayings in John's Gospel, where Jesus takes up this phrase, I am, and very consciously uses it to describe what he's like. And it is a very open and public declaration to those Jews who are listening, who understand Exodus 3 so well, a very open and public declaration, I am God come down. And in fact, in the culmination of that, at the end of John's Gospel, you get an amazing passage where they come to arrest him. And they say, are you Jesus? And he says, I am. And what happens to the soldiers? They fall over. Why on earth would they fall over at that point? Well, only because it's God saying his name in front of them and they fall flat on their faces. But that's a sermon for another time. So God reveals himself. Secondly, more briefly, God rescues his people. In verses 7 to 10, God reveals what he's been thinking to Moses. Back in chapter 2, we had a preview of what God thought of the situation. If you remember, God heard the groaning of his people in Egypt. He remembered his covenant, his agreement with Abraham. And now God explains that to Moses, verse 7. The Lord said, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their slave drivers, and I am concerned about their suffering. God sees. He's heard, he's concerned. And what's he going to do? Well, firstly, he's going to come down from heaven. I mean, that's remarkable in itself, verse 8. So I have come down. I mean, talk about a precursor for Jesus. I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Notice that God is not detached from his creation. He doesn't just sit in heaven, uninterested in what's going on down here. No, we have a God who is involved and active. He acts in time and space and history, and he's come down to rescue his people. This is God at work. This is God doing the very thing that shows his nature, that shows what and who he really is. Verse 9. The cry of the Israelites has reached me, and I have seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. He hears the call for mercy. He answers in saving power. God demonstrates his mercy and his love and his concern and his salvation in this act of delivering people. And then he sends Moses to be his representative, verse 10. So now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh. Moses, the man who's been in the man in preparation. Moses, who is one of the Israelites himself, God commissions him to go and enables him to do the job. And then Moses replies, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, I will be with you, and this will be a sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain. It's interesting how Moses himself has changed here. He no longer thinks that he can do the job. That's what I think was going on with the murder of the Egyptian slave master. It was Moses thinking he could do it. And now here we are on 40 years and Moses says, who am I? I can't do this. I just can't do it. It's too difficult. Not me. Well, in response to this confession of lowliness, God says that he will give Moses a sign. Now, what's weird about this sign? I'm really tempted for a bit of engagement here, but what is weird about this sign? What's going on with this sign? It is a weird sign, isn't it? I'll tell you what's weird about the sign, because you're just a bit hesitant. You don't know whether I'm really asking you a question or not. I'll tell you what's weird about this sign. You'll get the sign after you've done the job. That's weird. Do the thing, and then I'll give you the sign that you're going to do the thing. Yeah? Go and rescue these people, and to demonstrate that I'm with you, I'll bring you back to this place after you've done the job, and then you can worship here. That's a weird sign, isn't it? Most signs you would think would come before the event. They would be before the thing happened. Not here. But I think that's exactly how things are today, actually. How many of you have heard people say, or maybe even you've said this yourself, if only I could see something, I would believe. If only God would demonstrate himself, I would believe it. I had a friend when I worked at Danair. Well, I say he was a friend. He used to give me the most trouble of any person I've ever met in my whole life about my Christian faith. And he would come up to me sometimes in the morning and he would say, it's stupid. All this thing that you believe about God is stupid. But I would believe it if he would just show me, God, show me that you're there. I'm sure you've had people like that too. Maybe not so quite impolite as that, but people who said something similar. But God's word says that faith is being certain of what we do not see. And it's not till after we call on God for salvation, it's not until we put our hope in and trust in Christ, that we actually find the confirmation coming in our hearts. Isn't that true? The Spirit comes. We're transformed. And our eyes are opened. The sign comes after the event. Now, how does this point to Jesus? Well, I think in this rescue we have two distinct elements. We have God come down to rescue his people, and we have Moses, the representative of the people, the servant of God, saving God's people. In the whole of history, there is only one person where those two trajectories meet in. There's only one person that is both God come down and a servant sent to rescue God's people. And that is, of course, Jesus, isn't it? It only works in Jesus. There's nobody else like that. He's the only one who is God come down and the servant sent to rescue the people. He's called Emmanuel. That is God with us. His essential nature is divine. He is co-equal, co-eternal with the Father. Jesus really is God, the Son, come down to rescue his people. But he's also a man, truly a man. He's the representative of the human race. His human nature is as real as his divine one. As much as he is God, he is also human. Two distinct natures, one person. And as a man, he is the servant of God. You see, that's why the gospel, the good news about Jesus, is so tremendous. It's so wonderful. He is God come down to deliver and rescue. He is the servant who dies as our representative, bearing our punishment. And the great news is that he hears our cry for mercy. Just as surely as he heard the Israelites in Egypt, so he will hear us if we cry to him for mercy and forgiveness. So this morning, what we see is God chooses to reveal himself. We can know him. We can know him truly. We can know him personally because he has taken the first step. He's taken the initiative. He's revealed who he is. This is Yahweh, the true God. I am that I am. I am who I am. And then secondly, we see him as the rescuing God, Yahweh the rescuing God, supremely seen in his son Jesus, the one we should cry out to for mercy. He is the one who can rescue us from our sin and our rebellion and our slavery.